Men, imagine you are on your deathbed and you have a protege, perhaps a son, who's coming to say farewell to you and to, he knows it's going to be your last moments together. And he wants some piece of wisdom. He's waiting for you to teach him something. And you're going to teach him. You want to teach him something, something of value. You want him to live his life as a good man. And you're going to share something with him. What are you going to tell him? What are you going to teach him? What are your parting words? So that your protege, your son even, will grow into a good man. What do you tell him? Recently, over the past months and years, there's been a little bit of an awakening almost of regarding manhood and manliness. What does it mean to be a man? And you see this manifested in a lot of ways. There's a website that popped up a few years ago called theartofmanliness.com. And it has a lot of actually pretty reasonably good articles about manliness and what it is to be a man. You may have noticed the prevalence of beards of late, especially among younger men. There's this trend toward beards and chest hair. I was watching a TV show the other day, and there was this man walking around, and you could see chest hair, and I thought, all right, let's bring that back. You see ministers in various church organizations who have actually gotten in trouble for teaching about manliness. Some of them take some things to extremes, and they say things that I think were even intended to sort of be a little bit contentious and get people riled up. But you see people that are sort of getting in trouble for maybe overstepping their teachings about manliness. But I think there's this recognition that manliness has not always been something that has been valued over the last 10, 20, 30, 40, even 50 years. That manliness has sort of been on the decline. There are lots of articles, there are lots of blog posts, there are lots of people writing about manliness. So what does it mean to be a man? And we all have our notions of what manliness is. But what is manliness? Is it chest hair and beards? Is it strength? Is it power? What is manliness? What does it mean to be a man? I did a lot of research on this message. Probably the most important research was this morning with my children. I asked my boys what a man is. What do you think it means to be a manly man? They said, a man, the first response, strong. A man is strong. This is probably the number one trait associated with manliness, right? Strength. A man is strong. Interestingly, according to my children, the authorities on this, a man is kind. A man loves his children. A man is a gentleman. And according to one of my younger children, a man smashes stuff, climbs, and then falls down and dies. And that is what men do. And that's not too far off for some of us men. But it shows the perception. This is part of what manliness is. Sometimes we do smash stuff. Sometimes we do climb things and dominate things. And sometimes we fall down in the middle of doing something stupid and get injured or kill ourselves. It's a very manly quality. God himself has ideas about manliness. God created men and women. He created men to have certain traits. Turn over to Job 38. He makes a very interesting statement. Job chapter 38. This is toward the end of the book of Job. And Job has not spoken completely out of line, but he's said some things that were a little bit out of line. And so in Job 38 and verse 3, Job had been wanting an audience with God. He'd been wanting to talk to God. He'd wanted to plead his case with God. And so God gives him this opportunity. In verse 2, God speaking, he says, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge?" And he says, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you will answer me." Brace yourself like a man. God has an expectation that there's something about manliness here that's implicit in what he's communicating. Implied here, strength, fortitude. The word here, gird yourself, applied to warriors or soldiers. Normally a man would wear his robe and it would be long and flowing. When he says gird yourself like a man, or brace yourself like a man, it's a word that literally means take that garment, wrap it up so that you're ready to do battle. Gird yourself like a man. There's this expectation that Job is going to react in a way that is strong, that holds up under this challenge. He says, "I'm going to ask you a question." And he asks him a lot of questions. "I will question you and you will answer me." And God unleashes a whole stream of questions on Job that make him realize how small he is. But the expectation is not that he will just shrink and cower and sort of dissolve away, but that he will be strong and he will give an answer, that he will be able to respond. God has an expectation of men. He has an expectation of us. So today we'll consider commands that God gives to men, instructions that he gives us as men in general. We're not even going to dig into the commands that he gives to fathers necessarily or to husbands. He gives those things, commands about those roles that we fulfill as men sometimes. But we're going to look at some of the more general commands to men and about men. This isn't, again, a comprehensive thing. You can't sit here and say, here's what manliness is and put a stamp on it. But we can get a sense of it. And today we're going to try to get a sense of what biblical manliness looks like. Because our models of manliness, whether it's something that we learned from a father or some other father figure, or whether it's something that we've learned from television or something that we've learned from society, our models of manliness, if they're not aligned with what God is teaching, then our ideas are a little bit off, and perhaps we need to correct them. And we need to bring our ideas of manliness in line with what God wants us to be as men. Ladies, if you feel like you're a little bit tuned out here, don't tune out. For some of you, marriage is in your future. And if that is the case, then these are qualities that you want to look for in the men that you may marry. These are qualities you want to seek and qualities you want to find, because these are the things that God says men should be. If you're already married, praise these qualities. When you see these qualities, praise these qualities. It's not the kind of thing where you want to go home after a message like this and say, "Well, he said you're supposed to be this, this, and this, and this, and this." You got to do that. You better do that. I don't see you doing this one. I don't see you being like this. It's not going to work. We don't respond well to that as well as we might try. But if you see these qualities, when you see a man demonstrate these qualities, your husband, when you see him demonstrate these qualities, your children, when you see them, when you see your male children demonstrate these qualities, you praise them. If you're unmarried, there are instructions to the unmarried women to teach the younger women, to teach them. And it's very important for the older women to be able to teach the younger women, communicate with them. These are the things that you want to look for. These are the qualities that the Bible says you ought to be looking for in a man. So ladies, this isn't tuning you out. This is fairly directed at the men, but it's still relevant to you because there are men in your life. I'm sure of it. So if you were on your deathbed, men, what would you tell your son? Let's go to 1 Kings 2. 1 Kings chapter 2. In verse 1, When the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. So David is literally on his deathbed. He knows he's going to die. And Solomon comes and he's giving this charge to Solomon his son. In verse 2, "I am about to go the way of all the earth," he said. And then he gives him some instructions. And he teaches us about manliness. "So be strong. Show yourself a man. And observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in his ways and keep his decrees and his commands, his laws and requirements as written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you go." He gives him this command to be a man. Show himself a man. Be strong and show yourself a man, is what he commands him. Strength. Strength is this first quality we're going to look at. Because this is, again, this is probably the most dominant characteristic that we think of when we are thinking about manliness. It's something to do with strength. Strength is there at the core of it. Now, when we think strength, the first thing we sort of naturally think is physical strength. Right? A man smashes stuff. That's what men do, according to my little guy. It's a manifestation of strength. But physical strength is not the whole deal. Right? Physical strength is this visible manifestation of something that we value from within. Physical strength is something we can look at and we can say, that guy has this manly quality. And yet, we have many men and have seen many men who have great physical strength, who are very weak men, who are very poor men. Physical strength is sort of this evident ability for somebody to accomplish something, to do something, to endure something, perhaps. They have great strength, they can endure great trouble. Or they can overcome great adversity and great problems. They can accomplish, they can do whatever they want. And so we look at physical strength as a very apparent example of that. But it's just the outward manifestation. There's something inward that we tend to value highly. Think of the strongest man in the Bible. Think of Samson. We look at Samson and we go, yeah, that was a manly guy. But as men, none of us really strive to be like Samson. None of us look at his story and say, I want to be just like that guy. We'd like his strength, right? But he was weak in many areas. He turned it around at the end of his life. He demonstrated his strength there. But the strength that we admire there toward the end of his life is not so much about his physical strength, but his ability to overcome what he was put through and to turn back to God. It was his strength of character that we value. And so strength of character is really the core idea of strength that the Bible teaches is valuable as a manly value. When David is telling Solomon here, be strong, this isn't go hit the gym, you know. You got to hit the weights a little more frequently, right? Solomon, you're going to be king, so make sure that you really beef up. It's not the command. It's very evident here in the context. He's talking about a strength of character. He's talking about a strength of person. Strength of character is something that we value. It's sort of synonymous with power. Power is your ability to impose your will on the world, really. That's sort of what strength really comes down to. Strength and power is our ability to say, here's what I want to do. Here's my will. And I'm going to make this happen. I will have it happen. It will come to pass. This is one of those manly qualities. Now, obviously, imposing your will on the world is something that some men have done with great destructive effect. So purely imposing your will on the world or my will on the world is not what the Bible is getting at. But it is talking about this strength of character, a resolve. even. An undistracted purpose that we are set out to do, that God intends for us to do. Bundled up in this idea of strength here, in this word even, is the idea of courage. Be courageous. It's that fearless pursuit of a goal, of a purpose. These are all sort of bound together. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 13. Here Paul is giving this parting message to the Corinthians in his letter. And in verse 13 he says, "Be on your guard. Stand firm in the faith." In some translations it says, "Act like men." Or it says, "Be men of courage. Be strong." He's talking generally here, but the word here literally means act like men. It means act like men. And in the Greek in that day, it came to apply generally, right, to both men and women. He was encouraging all of them here. He wasn't just talking to the men. He was talking to the men and to the women. But the word here is a very manly word. It means act like men. Play the man, even. And so in the same way that some words generally have more masculine qualities or generally have more feminine qualities but are still applicable to all, this word is that way also. We think of the word nurture. And if we have to assign a gender to that word, we tend to assign that a female context. Right? Nurturing is seen as more of a female quality because men don't tend to be very good at it. It doesn't mean that all men are bad at it. It just means that it's not what we tend toward. Here, this idea of act like men or be courageous is, even in the language itself, it's a manly quality. And it goes back to that strength, that inner strength. Connotes bravery and courage. This is the manliness, the qualities that Paul is encouraging us to have, the Corinthians to have. It's that same kind of manliness that David encouraged his son to have, to be strong. Now, if we haven't seen this modeled, or we don't have good models of it, fortunately we have one right here. For all of these qualities that we're going to look at today, we can, of course, go to one single source as the demonstration of what manly qualities look like. Turn over to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4 and verse 13. Well, in verse 12, verse 11, it says it was He, Jesus Christ, that gave some to be apostles and prophets, evangelists, pastors and teachers, to prepare God's people for works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up, until we all reach the unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God, and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Jesus Christ. Other translations, it says to a mature man is literally how it's translated. Till we all come to a mature man. And it's saying that mature man, that mature person that we're supposed to become like, is demonstrated by Jesus Christ, the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. He modeled it. He modeled what these things should look like for all of us to strive for. But he came as a man. And so in that sense, we have this demonstration of what manliness is supposed to be. He is our model. He's our source. He is our measure of manliness. There have been attempts throughout time to sort of paint Jesus Christ as something, one thing or another. Some people have softened him to the point that he wasn't quite this man. He was, you know, sort of effeminate and something else. People have sort of shifted whatever he actually was into sort of their view of whatever the times they were living in. Others have gone the other direction and tried to make Jesus Christ sort of this super macho guy. He was this carpenter and he was buff and he was big and he, you know, he would smash things. Right? But we've got to be very careful to look at his example as what he is and not try to paint our ideas of manliness onto Jesus Christ. Because he really models it. And he does so in a really amazing way. He models this strength and this courage and this resolve for us. Let's go over to Matthew 16. He shows us what it looks like to be strong, to have this inner strength. Matthew 16 and verse 21. Here he demonstrates his resolve. This is his resolve. Here's he knows where he's going and he knows what he's doing and he's going to push right forward and do it. Matthew 16 and verse 21. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. So he not only understood this, but he was teaching his disciples that this is what was going to have to happen. Here's what's going to happen. It's not, I'm worried that this is going to happen. I need you guys to help me out. It was, this is where it's going. This is where I'm headed. And I just want you to know this ahead of time. He was resolved that this was going to happen. And in verse 22, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, he said. This shall never happen to you. And Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. He was firm. This is where he was going and this is what he was doing. And nothing, not even the attempts of people to help him to stop this all from happening was going to get in his way. His friends, his enemies, nothing was going to stop this. He knew exactly what he needed to do and what his purpose was. And he set his face to do it. He demonstrates courage. Let's go over to Matthew 26. Because he was approaching that point. And then finally he's in this moment. He's in this moment where he knows that what he told them was going to happen was about to start happening and it was going to get bad. So not only was he resolved to do it, but there in the moment he shows courage. He shows bravery. Matthew 26 and verse 53. Well, let's back up. Let's look at verse 50. The men stepped forward and seized Jesus and arrested him. And with that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword and he drew it out and he struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Here's a manly thing to do, right? He comes out and he's got his sword and he's going to hack this guy to pieces. And Jesus Christ says, put your sword back in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Here's where we get a glimpse of his bravery and his courage. Verse 53, do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way? He knew that at any moment he could make this all stop. He could just pause it all. Maybe just make it go away. Wrap up this whole plan. Burn this whole earth, get rid of everything, whatever it was he was going to do. But he didn't do that. He had the courage and the bravery to say, I'm moving forward with this. I could ask, he says. He could have asked. He could have asked for some sort of intervention to take this all away and none of this would be a problem. But here he demonstrates his courage and his bravery and moves forward with it, knowing where it was going. And ultimately, we know where it took him. Let's go back to Isaiah 53. Here, I think we get a really amazing picture of his strength. Isaiah 53. In verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted. And those words, I think, don't quite have the weight that we really need in our language. But he was oppressed and he was afflicted. We know the things that happened to him. He was beaten multiple times and drug out and crucified. So he was oppressed and he was afflicted. And yet he opened not his mouth. Here we see, we get a sense of this strength that he had. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. He didn't cry out even. He was strong the whole way through. And we know the source of his strength. Know that it was God. That this strength wasn't just simply something that he had because he was some Superman. He was very close with his Father. And that's where his strength came from. And so here we see in the worst moment, the most painful moment that perhaps we can even imagine, he didn't cry out. He didn't ask for this to stop. He didn't show weakness. He showed strength. And so we have this example of strength that we can follow. And we can look into, again, where he got this strength from. We're going to move on to some other qualities, but Jesus Christ sets us this example of courage, of bravery, of strength, manly qualities that we also need to be taking on. This strength of character to face the things that we are going to face. Because none of us are going to face anything like that. Nothing like he did. There have been some through history who faced similar things. But what he faced and what he endured, none of us are going to live up to or face up to that kind of thing. He really showed us what the ultimate measure of strength looks like. And it's something for us to follow. It's something for us to aspire to. It's something for us to dig into and learn about where that came from and why he had that strength. Going back to 1 Kings 2. 1 Kings 2 and verse 2. There's a lot here in what David is teaching Solomon when he's encouraging him here at the end of his life. 1 Kings 2 and verse 2 says, "So be strong and show yourself a man." We've looked at that. He says, "And observe what the Lord your God requires," or "keep the charge of the Lord your God." In that one little phrase, there are some very big things implied, and very, very big concepts. Keep the charge of the Lord your God. There are three big concepts we're going to look at here. Authority is one. Keep the charge of the Lord your God. It's implied here that Solomon was under God's authority. Solomon is not his own man. He's not free to just do whatever he wants because he's king. He's under the authority of God. God has charged him to do something. And David is implying here that Solomon is bound to do what God has charged him to do because he is under God's authority. So there's this concept of authority that we're going to look at. Responsibility. When it says keep the charge, this charge, it's the requirements is how it's translated in some of your Bibles. Keep the requirements of the Lord your God. Do what he requires of you. There are responsibilities that he lays on us. That's a natural part of having authority over someone. If you have authority over another individual, you're going to give them responsibilities and expect things out of them, require things out of them. So there's this idea of responsibility. And of course, there's this idea of duty. You have to keep the requirements of the Lord your God. You have a duty then to perform the things that he requires of you. We're going to look at these things. The authority, the responsibility, and the duty, or the fulfillment of that responsibility. Authority is really the who. It's the who. We're going to look at the who and the what and the how. But authority is who. All of us are under authority. Being a man is really about acknowledging that there is authority, that you are under authority. Now let's turn over to 1 Corinthians 11. All of us have some authority over us. And depending on our role, it's multiple authorities over us. But this is part of what we do. And fulfilling our roles as men requires that we acknowledge and understand the authority relationship that we have. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 3. Paul just says simply, I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ. He says, we have every man, every one of us in this room has Christ as our head. All the men. Christ is your head. He is your authority. He's my authority. He's the one that I am responsible to. We have other authorities that we are responsible to. If you have a job, you probably have a boss. If you don't have a boss, you probably have customers. There are people that you are responsible to. And those people are, in that sense, authorities over you. All of us ultimately have Jesus Christ as the authority over us. And everything that we do, really, has to reflect that we know that and acknowledge that and submit to that. Because really, a man's authority to lead, which is what we'll also look at, God expects men to lead. He expects that leadership attribute out of us. But a man's authority to lead is only maintained by his submission to the authority over him. As soon as we are no longer submitting to the authority over us, we really lose our authority to lead, because it's him that gives us that authority to lead. So we, as soon as we decide that we're going to step out of this chain of command, then we really have no authority to be leaders in any sort, because we're no longer a part of this structure. You'll recall elsewhere that it says there is no authority except that comes from God. All authority comes from him. So if we want to step outside of this chain of authority, then we no longer have authority either. We can't have authority because we're not subjected to it. A man's authority to lead is maintained by his willingness to submit to Jesus Christ. That principle applies wherever we're under authority. If we're at work and we have a boss and we decide we don't want to be under his authority and we undercut him, we're likely to find ourselves out of a job. This principle is fairly clear and fairly straightforward. We're under God's authority. Christ is the head of every man. But then the rest of the verse sort of starts to hint at our responsibility, our expectation. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 3 continues, and the man is the head of the woman. The man is the head of the woman. This is more in the context of the marriage. This isn't saying all men are over all women. Right? That's not what's implied here. It's not saying men are superior to women. But in the context of marriage, it says that the man is the head of the woman. There's an expectation of leadership here. And married or not, there's a principle here that we see throughout the Bible that men were designed to be leaders. Men are designed to take point on some things in pursuit or accomplishment of some goal. Doesn't always mean men are leaders of people and that men are going to take groups of people and lead them to do something. Sometimes it's individual pursuits. But there's this idea that men are designed to accomplish things, to go out and pursue things and do things. Right? And in that sense, lead an effort, even if it's an individual one. but to be composed enough to be able to lead. God expects leadership. Let's go over to 1 Timothy 2. There are some interesting ideas that we can learn out of what Paul teaches Timothy here. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 12. Paul talking to Timothy, I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent. This is talking about in the context of a church service. For Adam was formed first and then Eve. Notice the principle. Here's the principle that he's saying. He's saying the order in which God created us was intended to communicate to us something about our roles. God created Adam first and then Eve. He created men to have this primary leadership position and this responsibility. When you go back and you look at the interactions there, God created Adam, and then he taught him. He gave him some instructions. And then he created Eve as a helper to him. Now, that doesn't mean that he created women inferior. Again, that wasn't the teaching. But he created certain roles and certain positions for us to fulfill. And you can see this down through the scriptures. God, when he's interacting with people, he primarily interacts with the men. The interactions that we see are primarily with the men. We see some exceptional cases. We see where God works with directly with women or appears directly to women. Those tend to be the exception. We see God interacting directly with Abraham, with Noah, with Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. On down the line, you see that he requires that all the priests were men. In the New Testament, we see deacons and we see elders described as men. God created men to have these positions of leadership, to be able to step into positions of leadership and to be able to fulfill these positions of leadership. Jesus Christ came as a man. He didn't come as a woman. He came as a man. In Isaiah 3 and verse 12, if you want to turn over there, you don't need to. The context there is simply that God is chiding Israel. And he says that they have some qualities that are problematic. One of the things that he says is that women rule over them. And he's implying that there's something unnatural about that. That wasn't the way that he intended it to happen. When he says women rule over them, he was saying this as sort of a remark against them. Not a remark against women, but a remark against men. Let's continue in 1 Timothy 2, verse 14. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. People sometimes look at this and say, well, obviously the woman was weaker or whatever it is. That's not what he's teaching here. Notice, he says it was not Adam who was deceived. He wasn't unclear on what was going on. Adam failed to lead. He understood what was supposed to happen. He understood the instructions that he had been given. And he did not lead. He just sort of rolled along with it and said, okay, we'll do whatever. He failed to lead. When men fail to lead, when men fail to step into that position that God designed us for, terrible things happen. There are tragedies that happen. You'd say that everything that happened there in Genesis 3 was a failure of a husband to lead in a correct and proper way. He just didn't do it. God expects us to do that. He expects us to step into the positions of authority that he gives us, whatever those may be, to recognize what they are, to recognize the authority over us, and then to fulfill those positions of leadership. Let's go back to 1 Kings 2 and verse 3. He tells us how to go about that. He tells us what he expects. 1 Kings 2 and verse 3, continuing with David's thoughts. He says, observe what the Lord your God requires of you. Walk in his ways and keep his decrees and his commands and his laws and his requirements as written in the law of Moses. He says, here's how you're going to fulfill this. He wants him to be a man. And he wants him to fulfill what God has required of him. He says, you do that by fully obeying his laws and his commands. We do that by fully walking in what his law teaches us. And we know and we understand that his law is a way of love. Let's go over to Matthew 20. Matthew 20 and verse 27. Now up to this point, maybe it sounded a little bit exciting. God has given us authority. Right? He puts us under authority and then he calls us into these positions of authority. And he tells us that we have this leadership responsibility and this role that he expects us to man up to, in a sense. And that's exciting. We like that. We say, oh, great. God expects me to have some sort of leadership and control and power, and I'm going to go and be a man and do these things. And I am going to impose my will on the world, change the world the way that I see fit. But that's not what he's given these things to us for. He's given us authority. He's given us these opportunities to lead. And those opportunities can be devastating to people unless we do them in the way that he teaches here. Matthew 20 and verse 27. Whoever wants to be first among you must be your slave. When we hear the word leadership, we should think servitude. That's what leadership is. That's the kind of leadership that he's called us to. He hasn't called us to this leadership that asserts its authority and asserts its dominance over people. That's not the kind of manly leadership that God expects. In this world, that's valued sometimes as manliness. For a man to be able to take his will and his idea of things and change the world and bend and shape the world to his idea and to his will. Sometimes it's fairly innocuous. Sometimes it doesn't really matter much because maybe that person doesn't have all that much weight or all that much power. Or maybe the things that that person is trying to manipulate to his own will don't have that far-reaching of an impact. Sometimes they do. You get the Hitlers and the Stalins of the world. These are men who bent the world to their will and imposed their will on people at the cost of millions of lives. That's not the kind of manliness that God expects. That's not why he gives authority. That's not why he gives us leadership opportunities. That's not what he calls us to. He calls us to servitude. Woodrow Wilson wrote a very interesting, a short but very interesting essay called When a Man Comes to Himself. And he sort of captured some of these ideas in a way that was very relevant here. I'll read a little excerpt of that. This was written in 1901, before Woodrow Wilson became president. He said, "And assuredly, no thoughtful man ever came to the end of his life and had time and a little space of calm from which to look back upon it, who did not know and acknowledge that it was what he had done unselfishly and for others, and nothing else, that satisfied him in the retrospect and made him feel that he had played the man." And so men grow by having responsibility laid upon them, the burden of other people's business. This is what's intended for us. This is what we are supposed to do. Woodrow Wilson went on to become a public servant. This is the kind of leadership that God expects of us. Right? Public servant, when you think of it that way, we don't have many public servants. We have a lot of people in office. We don't have a lot of public servants. People who understand that leadership is about servitude to others. And that's where we need to start bringing our ideas of leadership to, as to what he's teaching here, that leadership is all about selflessness, is all about sacrifice. Understanding that we may have our will, we may have our way that we want to shape the world, and the things that we want to do and the things that we want to accomplish individually. We're men, that's what we do. We make plans to do things and get this stuff done and move this forward and accomplish this and slay this dragon and save this princess. We have these plans for these things. But we have to learn that what he's teaching here is that we take all of those things and we put those things aside. And unless those things are in line with serving others, with the will of God, with what he wants for other people, that we're going to abuse our leadership, that we're going to abuse our authority, and that we will not be godly men. Jesus, of course, modeled all of this. He modeled what authority, what responsibility, what duty look like. He showed these things to us. Let's go over to John 5. We're going to skip around a little bit here. But he shows us these things. He models these things. John 5 and verse 30. I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. He says that on his own, he can't do anything. That the only reason he can even do anything is because he's fully submitting to the authority that's over him. He's fully acknowledging God's authority over him and his role and his position and his purpose. And he's saying that his whole life was about submitting to that authority and doing what his Father wanted him to do. Maybe just across the page for you, John 6 in verse 38. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Again, he's talking about authority here. He's saying, I didn't come here to have my own authority and my own realm and dominion. Satan offered him that. Satan offered him the opportunity to have his own authority and dominion and power and rule. And he rejected it because he knew that that wasn't the authority that he was going to submit to. He was submitting to the authority of the Father, and that was it. And he came and he lived his entire life that way. At the end of his life, as he prayed to God in the garden, he said, not my will. He wanted some other way that maybe this could work out. There's a way for this thing to change. That'd be great, but not my will. Your will, he says. He's fully submissive to the authority that's over him. And that's the example that we have. Back over in Matthew 27. Matthew 27. Matthew 20, in verse 20, 27, well, verse 28. Matthew 20 and verse 28. So he's just told us in verse 27, whoever wants to be first must be your slave. He's telling us, here's the idea of servitude. And then he says, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Here he's showing that he understood his responsibility and his duty. He knew what his responsibility was. He came to serve. He came to be that servant, to model what leadership looks like, to model servitude, and to show us what proper authority looks like when it's exercised. He came and exercised authority fully in line with his responsibilities, understanding that his responsibilities, again, were not to be served, but to give his life, to give up everything that he was and everything that he has as a ransom for many. And we're told over in Hebrews 4 that he did this without sin. He did this fully obeying all of God's laws, all of his statutes, all of his commandments, everything that God commands and wants us to be and wants us to do. Jesus Christ did that fully and perfectly, and we know that. But he came and modeled these things. He understood authority, responsibility, duty, and he lived them. And so God says over in Isaiah 53, turn over there, Isaiah 53 and verse 12. Isaiah 53 and verse 12. God sums up the way that Jesus Christ lived and died this way. He says, "Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong." Here he's describing him in these heroic, manly terms as a hero. "I'll divide him a portion with the great and spoil with the strong," as one who conquered, as one who came and won. "Because he poured out his soul unto death," and he understood the selflessness involved and the duty that he had to do that. "And he was numbered with the transgressors. He bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors." So Jesus Christ fulfilled these things, this strength that we've been looking at, the authority that he acknowledged, the responsibility he had, the duty that he had. We have him as our model for biblical manliness. Biblical manliness from the things we've looked at today. A biblical man is going to do these things, at least these things and more. A biblical man will acknowledge the authority that he is under. First and foremost, we'll acknowledge that we are not our own men, but we are under authority. We'll put aside our selfish desires, the selfishness that will drive us to abuse the authority that God has given us. We'll put those things aside. And we'll make our life's work the welfare of other people. That's what our purpose is. God's given us leadership and authority so that we can care for other people, to use those for his interests, to take care of others. And we'll persevere in that work with strength, with courage, and with resolve. So let's be godly men.